Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Maybe the most famous person who lives in Chapel Hill is Jean Anderson. She's the author of more than 20 cookbooks, including one that was bestseller. Well, more than one that's a bestseller, but for many people, the most memorable was the Double Date cookbook. That's and Jean Anderson cooks. But more recently for me and for Chapel Hill, a book, A Love Affair with Southern Cooking, has become a classic. This is something that came out, I guess, three or four years ago.
Yeah.
Just recently, UNC Press reissued Jean Anderson's Preserving Guide. That's a great, you know, if you're looking for presents, that's the great one. And then, I don't know, my new favorite is From a Southern Oven, The Savories and the Sweets by Jean Anderson. It has just come out. And so, Jean, Chapel Hill, Jean Anderson, thanks for coming to visit with us, DJ. About this.
It's always a pleasure.
Well, I know you don't like to talk about food or cooking, but I'm going to maybe force you to do this. This is a mean question, so get ready for it. Look, don't we have enough cookbooks? It's like Civil War books. People just love them. They keep buying them.
And enough Southern cookbooks.
Yeah.
Because these keep coming out and coming out and coming out. I don't know, but no, I don't think we have enough. And the thing is about Southern, when you think of regional American cuisines, there is none. There's no area of this country that has given us more than the South. I mean, if you think of New England, what are the classic dishes that have come out of New England?
Clams.
New England clam chowder, Boston cream pie, Boston baked beans, Johnny cake, and what else? California, you've got Cobb salad, green goddess salad, Chapino, lots of stuff made with tofu, and what else? But you talk about the South, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of classic recipes that have come out of the South.
You're a real partisan. You know,
yeah.
I love it. You're unapologetic about this because now these days we say the same thing about writing and literature, that Southern literature is special. But sometimes a Southern author is kind of back away from it. I'm not a Southern writer.
I'm a writer.
Right. I'm not bound by my region anymore. It's America has either been Southernized or we've been Americanized,
right.
They say. But food-wise, you don't go that direction. You say
no, absolutely not. And I think it probably has to do with the fact that I was born and brought up in Raleigh, but both of my parents were, quote, Yankees.
Right.
And I was always considered the little Yankee girl. My mother cooked what she had grown up with in Illinois and also a few things that she had picked up in Boston when she went to Wellesley. She never cooked Southern. And the first time I really ate honest-to-God Southern food was school lunch, the Fred A. Olds Grammar School in West Raleigh. And you know, back then, D.G., we had good country cooks in the kitchen. Everything was prepared fresh every day. So I ate my first collard greens.
Oh, did you like them from the beginning, or did you have to develop a taste?
But the thing that really hooked me was brown sugar pie.
And they did that in the school lunch cafeteria?
Absolutely, they did that in school lunch.
I wish I'd gone to school there.
Yeah. And, you know, then even at Needham Broughton, they had, when I, you know, moved on or, you know, moved up, also cooks in the kitchen. Which, you know, and I think today it's all prefab. They're vending machines.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
it's terrible.
But did you go home and tell your mama, you need to cook better? Did you have a dialogue with her?
No. What I did was to befriend a lot of classmates whose mamas were good Southern cooks. And I would sort of say, I'll go home with you and play after school, hoping that I would be invited to stay for dinner. And I often was. And so, you know, I got more and more and more. And then when I was, I don't know, 8 or 10, a really fascinating country woman moved into our neighborhood. And she was just around the corner. And every time, you know, when I would get home from school, I would just fly over to her house and watch her make hoe cakes and cook greens and cook pork chops and all kinds of stuff. And I think the fact that my heritage, you know, is not Southern makes me much more of a student of Southern cooking.
Well, that's interesting, but you're kind of a passionate student.
Yeah.
A student or you're an evangelist. You're not. I mean, you love
proselytize.
Yeah, right.
And I did a lot of that when I lived in New York for years and years and years. I would invite people for, you know, Thanksgiving dinner, and what I cooked was Southern. And part of the group was Southern, but others, you know, were born and bred New Yorkers, and they were always fascinated. And the thing that I was lucky about, although in Raleigh growing up I was considered the little Yankee girl, when I began working in New York as a magazine editor,
they thought you had a deep Southern accent.
Yes, exactly. So I got all the Southern assignments. I would be sent to states I'd never been in, like Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama and, you know, Kentucky. And it was a great education. And I love to collect recipes. And the first thing I do when I hit a town is to go to the local independent bookstore. And I go to the area where they have the local cookbooks, the fundraisers, you know, those little
spiral. So you go, you're the fan, you'll go because you can't get those any other place in the local
bookstore. Well, I love the independent bookstores.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah.
And I love the independent cookbooks. And for me, the gold standard will always be the original Charleston Receipts, because it has such a sense of time and place, which I think is essential. I mean, today there are now packagers who will put together a fundraiser for any, you know, church or
They'll take local recipes, but some.
But they usually don't. It's the standard thing. You see them come out.
Watch out then.
So yeah, they'll
watch out that it looks local, but they've really just sold the idea
exactly.
to the local.
You know, if I'm in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, I am not looking for burger stroganoff. I'm not looking for lasagna. You know, I'm not looking for.
So what do you do? And now let me push you on this. We got to get to your book, From a Southern Oven, and the Savories and Sweets, your new book. But I'm interested in that process in the sense of you're a reporter, a collector, in some sense. And so where do you get your information? And one of the places you say is in the independent bookstores in different towns where they're selling the real legitimate
local.
Junior league or church or family
community fundraisers.
Where they collect. And so you open it up and here, I'm just thinking, well, a lot of those recipes are just kind of the ones that they read that have become favorites, but they're anything unusual.
Nothing to do with the sale.
And then you find, you keep flipping through it, and you find something you really think, my gosh, I've never seen this.
If there's one new recipe in the book that fascinates you, it's worth buying the book. But many of them really have dozens of recipes and, moreover, dozens of really handed-down colonial recipes that are sort of written in that shorthand. You know, it's almost like the fake music book.
Butter
the size of an egg and, you know, all of this. And they assume you know how to put everything together.
You're a finder of heritage, but that's not enough. You can't just Xerox that and send it to your publisher. You've got to
something with her. I develop absolutely everything. And my very first job after I got a master's in journalism at Columbia in New York, and I landed in the test kitchen of the Ladies' Home Journal magazine, not exactly what I had in mind when I got a
master's
degree.
Sounds pretty good to me.
Well, it was a foot in the door. But boy, I will tell you, I had never tested a recipe. It's not just cooking. It's a very specific science.
What do you mean? I mean, why don't you just take the recipe, follow the directions, see if it works, and if it does?
No. When you test a recipe, first of all, every measurement has to be absolutely precise. And then when it comes to the method, you have to give the size of the pan, whether it's deep or shallow, whether it's non-reactive. You have to give the burner heat. You have to tell exactly how long it takes to melt the butter, how long it takes to brown the onion, which, of course, varies according to the quantity. It's step by step by step by step. And frankly, it's a pain in the neck. I love to cook, but when you're testing, you have to stop and write everything down.
So does it usually work after two or three times that you get it right, or do you have to go
Usually. Well, I try to make it work the first time through because my undergraduate degree is food chemistry from Cornell. So, I really learned why things—
Well, this is so you must see a recipe sometimes and look at it and it looks like it's going to be good at the end, but you just say, this is not going to work. This is not going to work. I got to fix
this. I got to fix it. Right. And that is exactly what we did, with the Ladies' Home Journal. But one of the things that was a true learning experience and certainly prove the importance of testing is that any food editor, and there was a whole sort of professorial ranking that went on at magazines, if your byline was on a particular food story and if there was a recipe that had a mistake and you got, crank letters from the readers, then you had to reimburse them out of your own
pocket. So not your recipe. You're sharing a recipe that looks
tested.
But then you don't just, as we said just earlier, you don't just copy that recipe and publish it and attribute
it
to somebody. You've got to, and you learned this, because if you didn't test it, or even if you did test it and it didn't work, your publisher was going to make you pay.
That's right. And it happened to me on my very first—
How much did it cost you?
A lot.
What do you mean,
why? I felt very poor. Well, I had been sent to California. We did this in the Ladies' Home Journal, and perhaps some people will remember this, a whole series called How America Lives. And there was a big main feature about a family somewhere in the U.S. And then there were all these ancillary features. There would be beauty, there would be decorating, there would be food. So I was sent to California to do a food story to interview a woman in San Bernardino. And one of her favorite recipes, which I had tested in the Journal kitchen after I got back to New York, was cranberry nut bread. And it appeared in a November issue just in time for Christmas gift giving. And, the whole business from test kitchen to print is very long and involved. Lots of galleys, lots of people reading, etc. It was fine in the test kitchen. It was fine, I think, halfway through, and then suddenly somewhere down the line, the baking powder got left out. And boy, did I get crank letters. And the other thing, DG, that just amazes me.
Got left out in the printing process.
Oh, in the magazine, yes. There was no baking powder. And all of a sudden, I was getting all of these nasty letters. And I don't know why readers do this, but they see a recipe that appeals to them, and then they think, well, I'll just triple it. So
what's wrong with that?
Well, if you're baking, it's a very bad idea.
I tell you what, we need to take a break.
Okay.
And when you mentioned baking, and I'm going to come back and talking about baking, we're going to start talking about ovens.
Right.
And we're going to start talking about From a Southern Oven,
good,
your newest book.
Good.
And I'm visiting with Chapel Hill's Jean Anderson about cooking, and it's in the context of her latest book, From a Southern Oven. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Jean Anderson. She's, I think, maybe Chapel Hill's most famous person across the country because she writes with passion about Southern food. And her latest book is From a Southern Oven, The Savories and the Sweets. And, Jean, we've been talking about sort of the process, and we could go on for days, I think, or at least I could.
Right.
So let's stop that and talk about baking and the Southern oven, and you've been going around talking about this book. What's your elevator spiel about this book?
Well, my mission really with this book, in a way, it is a sequel to A Love Affair with Southern.
Well, for just excuse me for interrupting, but if anybody joined us late, I have a love affair with Southern cooking because it's a combination. It is just a classic history, cooking, regional book that every Southerner should own. All right. Now, go back. You say your new book, From a Southern Oven, is sort of a sequel.
It is sort of a sequel because in the course of researching this, and I notice you do not have the Beard Best Cookbook decal for that book because it did win the Beard Best Regional.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Well, send me that decal and I'll place it on that book.
That decal, yeah. Well, I have to say the publisher was a little late getting them on. However, in the course of researching that book, I discovered many, 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 many things that Southerners bake that are not achingly sweet. I think non-Southerners have the idea that everything that comes out of a Southern oven is a chess pie or something equally rich that sort of hangs in the tonsils and hurts, you know, when you swallow it. There are so many savory dishes, appetizers, main dishes, side dishes, breads that Southerners bake. And I thought, you know, I really want to do a book that gives the whole true picture of Southern baking that is not totally, totally focused on all the wonderful sweets that we do. And it's so funny because even in production, the title of this book, they would send me the design and it would come back from a Southern oven, the sweets, comma, the savories. And I said, no, 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 reverse it, the savories.
Why? Well, why? We're not ashamed of our sweets, are we?
No, 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 but my focus here is to prove that everything is, well, there are sweets in it, but I think they're it's probably about two-thirds savory dishes.
Well, talk to it, just to help define the term savories.
Unsweet.
Savory is unsweetened. Okay. Well, give us an example or two of a savory that's just on your mind right now. Well, you know, as you're thinking about cooking for the holiday season, maybe one of these dishes will
pop up. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly party time, and I'm writing right now, as I think I mentioned before we went on air, a piece for the Wall Street Journal, which is all about Southern Christmas and how people entertain and how they also bake ahead, you know, to give people things from, you know, their own kitchens. But one of the recipes in this book and one of the ones that I'm taking to my various book signings is something called pecan cheddar pennies. And man, they are killer. I mean, people are just scarfing these down.
All right. First of all, is this in your book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Pecan pennies. So
yeah.
What are they made of?
Well, pecans.
Pecans, of course.
Pecans. Hyphen cheddar pennies. But the grated, it's a very, very simple dough. I mean, they're ground up pecans, there's grated cheddar cheese, there's flour, there's paprika, there's some cayenne.
And do you put any rising in there?
No.
You just warm up that dough.
What you do is you shape the dough into a log.
So just, Gene, excuse me because this is something I think I'm not much of a cook, but I think I can understand this. So you grind up the pecans into kind of a flour. I mean, you grind them up.
Well, no, the texture of kosher salt.
Okay, so little tiny bits of pecans, and then
food processor,
and then the cheese.
Grate the cheese.
You just grate it, or now some people just buy grated cheese.
No. You need to get your own cheddar,
and you grate it into little.
Coarsely grated.
All right, so those are the two ingredients, and then
butter and flour.
Then, butter and some flour.
And some flour. Well,
not,
yes, absolutely.
Not self-rising, but regular flour.
Regular flour.
And then
flour.
You just mix all that up.
Well, paprika, sweet paprika, cayenne, freshly grated nutmeg. And you could do the whole thing in the food processor. You just sort of pulse until the dough comes together. Then you shape the dough into a log or a couple of logs. Wrap it in, you know, plastic wrap or foil, either refrigerate or freeze. Then, when you want them, you just slice a quarter of an inch thick, bake on ungreased sheets. I think they bake 10 to 12 minutes. Cool them and serve them. I mean, it's a great make-ahead for, you know, open house, for gift-giving, for whatever. I mean, they are, as I said, I've been serving them at the various book signings, and they disappear mighty fast.
You didn't bring any to me today.
I know. I was just thinking that. You know,
you're getting me all excited, and then I'm my math. No.
I will bake you some.
But so this is something that somebody like me, like I could cook this.
Yes, you could.
And so I like that. But
very high, they're very, very short, meaning a lot of butter, a percentage of butter to flour. I think there's a half a cup of butter in a cup of flour.
Now, I'm curious about this, Gene. This is from a Southern oven.
Yeah.
And so you're collecting recipes and then testing them, in some cases adjusting them. And then every now and then, do you just make one up that's in the Southern tradition?
I do.
How does this one fit?
This is sort of a variation on a theme. You know, we all love cheese straws. We all love cheese daisies. And I thought, you know, why not grind up some pecans and put in there?
So this is yours. In the Southern tradition.
Well, it's a variation.
It's a variation. It's a variation of an old Southern
but
classic.
A creation that I did, which is also an appetizer. We all love pecan tassies, you know, those little bite-sized pecan pies. And I thought, you know, why not do a savory? So what I did was to do with mushrooms and onions and, you know, serve them in little cups. But instead of using, like, pie pastry, I just used thin sandwich bread, which you can poke down into little mini muffin pan cups and bake them so they're crisp, and then fill them with this wonderful mushroom mixture.
I'm sorry to get diverted, but I love – so you can just take regular old white bread.
Yes.
And you – you know, sometimes I do that. We just kind of push all the air out of it and then you just put it into a little
You cut it into circles.
Cut it into circles and push
and then
it down
push
into,
it into these little mini muffin
yeah,
pans.
Yeah, and then you bake that.
Bake for, it for, I don't know, 8 to 10 minutes at 350.
Toast it. Just kind of
yeah,
like you toast
lightly,
it.
Lightly.
And then so you take that out and then you put whatever sort of savory pie that you put in there.
Yeah, you can do crab. I mean, I had a friend in New York that lived in the same apartment building who was from Dillon, South Carolina, and that was her great Christmas open house, were crab cups that were put in these same little toasted, you know, white bread.
So instead of going to the grocery store or specialty store and getting these real expensive
pie shells,
yeah,
you know,
pie shells,
tart
cheat,
shells.
You cheat by getting a 99-cent loaf of bread and turning it into
– has to be firm textured.
What do you mean by that?
Well, can I say a brand name?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. It should be, you know, sandwich bread, but Pepperidge, Arnold, those are
what's
known.
What would be the getting the generic grocery store brand white bread? That
well,
might
you,
work.
You need this sort of country firm texture. You can't right. use squishy white bread.
Oh,
it has to be firm enough not to fall apart when you push it down into the little muffin pan cups.
Well. Let's take another break. I'm floored. I want to go back and make some of these. We're visiting with Jean Anderson. We're talking about her latest book. It's called From a Southern Oven, The Savories and the Sweets. And she and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is Jean Anderson. During the break, she said we got to talk about moldy mice. So let's talk about moldy mice. I don't know
if I want to
talk about moldy mice or not.
I think you do. This is another one that I am serving at book signings.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should say, Jean, that if anybody joined us late, you live in Chapel Hill. You bring honor and fame to our town because you're known throughout the country as a cook. Book author, a recipe developer and tester, and a trustworthy advocate for our way of living.
Thank you.
So, what about this moldy mice?
Well, moldy mice, they are a sweet. However, they're cookies. However, the recipe, I was looking at it the other day, and there is only 1 tablespoon of sugar in the dough.
For a whole bunch of them? For a whole bunch
of
them?
Yeah, for about 2.5.
So is that savory or is that still sweet?
No,
or
it's
is it
sweet,
savory?
And I'll tell you why. It's a recipe, actually, that I got when I was living in New York. A good friend of mine was Mariah Harrison Rue. She was a young editor at Gourmet, and she was a Harrison of Virginia, you know, grew up in plantation country on the James River, Tidewater, Virginia. And she kept talking about this Christmas cookie that was way back in her family. And she said, I said, well, what's the name of it? And she said, moldy mice. And I said, well, is that like the thing we know as Mexican wedding cakes, you know, which are made with crumbs and nuts and, you know, shaped into balls and rolled in confectioner's sugar? And she said, no, not really, because they are absolutely chock full of sesame seeds. She said, it's butter, it's flour, it's sesame seeds and vanilla. And then you shape the dough into little ovals that look like little mice, and you bake them. And as soon as they come out of the oven, you roll them in confectioner's sugar.
Ah, so that makes them sweet.
That's the additional sugar, right? And, you know, they do look sort of like little moldy mice. And I had never made these. And I thought, you know, I emailed Mariah, who now lives out on the North Fork in Long Island. And I said, you know, would you let me use that old family recipe? And she said, sure. So she sent it to me. And I tested it. And man, I mean, you know, I was giving it away in the neighborhood. I'm sorry, DJ.
I thought
I'll put you on the list, right?
I'd like to be on your list, that's for sure.
It is one that I am taking to the, you know, take the book signings.
Well, I'm looking forward to do that. You gave us one recipe that you said I could do. Now, can I do this one?
Oh, absolutely. Piece of cake. And, you know, children love to help shape these things. You know, it's something.
To make the mice.
Well, and you know, the pecan cheddar pennies, too. It's all, you know, working with your hands. And great if you could get the children, you know, to help. That's wonderful.
Well, Gene, when you get ready for holidays and you've got all this lore of cooking and you have a sense of what can be done, I don't want to say quickly, but with ease rather than a cooking chore that is going to be torture to get ready. And maybe you're invited to other people's to bring potluck or something like that. Share with us your favorites. And if they come from your new book, From a Southern Oven, that's great. If they don't, just what would be something you could whip together real quickly?
Well, the couple of things that I'm always asked to bring and probably will this Thanksgiving. Number one is something called candied bacon, which is in a love affair with Southern cooking. Have you ever heard of that?
I can't remember that. I should remember.
It's an appetizer.
Candied bacon.
Yeah. And what you
do. This sounds like the state fair where you deep fry. Instead of frying bacon, you deep fry sweets.
No, it's very easy. And people, again, it's something I take to book signings and they look at the little label and they're like, I don't think I want to try that. And then they take a piece and you can just see the, you know, the eyes sparkle and then they go back for another piece. But you, first of all, you need a really good quality bacon. And we'll cut a strip probably into three pieces of equal size. Roll them in a mixture of light brown sugar, powdered mustard. I think there's a little bit of probably freshly ground pepper. I'm not sure. But anyway, you coat them well. Then you put them on a rack on a baking sheet, and you bake them.
It's got to have a little thing to.
Because you want the fat to drip through.
To drip, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And I can't remember exactly how long, you know, you bake them, but until they're nice and brown and crisp. And then you take them out and you cool them and you serve them.
Just like it's crisp?
Very crisp.
Hard crisp.
When they cool, they crisp up.
And this is appetizer, dessert, or what?
Great with cocktails. No, it's not dessert. It's an appetizer. For sure.
Wow. Now, is that Southern or did you just kind of make
Southern.
That up?
And again, that's something that I kept discovering in community fundraisers.
That's when
I was researching a love affair with Southern cooking.
Wow. Now, all right. Well, that's your appetizer.
But then
what if you want a main dish?
I always like my pecan pie.
What's special about your pecan pie?
And this I really learned from Karen Barker, you know, of our late lamented Magnolia Grill. Karen would brown the butter, you know, so it was sort of topaz color and has this wonderful, wonderful flavor. And I thought, what a brilliant idea. And the other thing that Karen did with her pecan tart was to toast the pecans a bit.
Before they go into
the pie, yeah. So it deepens the flavor.
So I don't want to push you into this, but just for somebody who says, I've got my own pecan pie recipe, but I'm going to do those two things in addition, that would be a good idea?
I think so, because pecan pie needs to be richer, but it really deepens
it
the
deepens
flavor.
It deepens the flavor by browning the butter
and toasting the pecans
a little bit before you start with them.
Right.
Now, what else is special?
Well, my pecan pie does not have any corn syrup in it. It's basically light brown sugar and butter and vanilla and eggs. And I think that's pretty much it.
So, no, you know, I think a corn syrup is providing a little liquid, extra liquid in there.
You don't need it.
In other words, if I get a pecan pie that tastes like Jell-O because it's got too much, that's not your pie.
No, and a lot of people, I mean, I think dips pie is wonderful. She uses light corn syrup. Most people would use the dark corn syrup. And I think her pecan pie is wonderful. And she serves it warm, by the way, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, well.
But my pie is just different.
Well, what takes the place of the corn syrup?
Greater percentage of butter.
I mean, more butter, more sugar. More butter, more sugar.
More eggs, yeah. Yeah.
To get the soft ingredients. I mean,
it really has. It cuts beautifully. You know, when you cut it, the slice will hold, but it's wonderfully tender.
Well, when are you going to be testing that recipe out again?
I may be making it for Thanksgiving for my potluck.
We're visiting with Gene Anderson, talking about the holidays, but mainly talking about her latest book, From a Southern Oven. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Gene Anderson, Chapel Hill's famous cookbook author, a recipe tester, magazine writer, Iredale County Home Extension agent, and famous everywhere, is talking with us around the release of her latest book, From a Southern Oven. And Gene, we've just got a little bit of time, and we haven't really talked too much about some of your favorite dishes in the book. And so what did we miss?
Well, in the course of research, I mean, as I've already said, I love looking at these community fundraisers. And often you will find a truly early, you know, even colonial recipe.
Do you collect these recipes? If I go to your house, have you got a whole shelf full of these?
I've got hundreds, thousands. And when I moved down from New York, I had to get rid of like 87 cartons of books, which nearly killed me. Most of them were the community fundraisers. But I have really hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them.
And do you go back to them to look again?
All the time, yeah. I love looking at them. But in the course of researching this particular book, I came across two very, very early Southern recipes, one of which was called Blind Hare. And I thought, good grief, I've never heard of that. What is it? I was thinking it had to have rabbit in it.
When I saw that recipe, I thought it was.
But it is, in fact, a meatloaf. And it has beef, pork, and ham, and a lot of seasonings, shaped into a loaf on a baking sheet. And then it's coated with crumbs and baked. And it's really very good.
Why is it good?
Well, I mean, it's a wonderful combination of meats, and I love the idea of crispy crumbs on the top.
Let me ask you about this, because you combine the meats, and you really lose the mixture. It's like mixing wine or something like that. You may get something that's better, but you lose touch. If somebody likes,
I don't think when you're making meatloaf, I mean, you know, even in supermarkets, they sell meatloaf mix, which is a combination of meats. And I think beef and pork and ground ham is really terrific. You, of course, can get ground beef. I always like chuck. I think it makes.
And you grind your own?
No.
You buy ground chuck.
And you can get ground pork these days. If you can't, you could substitute ground turkey. The thing that's more difficult is to get ground ham. I don't know why, because ham usually is cooked. So, you know, you don't have the.
So do you your own, or you have to go?
Yeah, I've done it at a food processor. It's not as effective, I think. You know, it's when I was a kid, you know, we had the old-fashioned meat grinder.
Oh, I would have thought you might have had one of those in your kitchen.
No, I don't. But I think this particular recipe is very easy, serves a lot of people, and it's just a really
good. What would be the occasions that this would be good for?
Well, you know, I think it's elegant enough for a small dinner party. I mean, you know, it's a conversation piece, number one. You know, what
you,
is
you
it?
Can tell the story of the hair.
Exactly. And another dish that I found that I didn't know at all is something called colonial chicken pudding.
Which is
pudding served in a wonderful sort of egg-thickened sauce.
So the chicken that comes out, and you got the chicken
it's
a sauce.
It's disjointed, yeah.
And you pull your chicken piece out, and it looks like Jell-O in there, sort
no,
of.
No. It's a lovely, lovely gravy consistency.
It's a great. It's more like. I mean, I would understand it better if you said chicken and gravy instead of chicken and.
But pudding, it isn't but really a gravy. I mean, it's a very pale.
What's the difference?
Well, fewer of the drippings and more cream and milk, you know, go into it,
and it develops a pudding consistency.
Well, it would be like stirred custard.
Yeah.
You know, but not sweet. But I think that's a lovely recipe. There's another one called chicken boudin, which was created by a caterer in Athens, Georgia. And it's sort of like leftover chicken and rice and onions and all kinds of things and sherry. You know, that is another very – there are worlds of casseroles in this book.
Is that recipe, boudin, is that something you could use – leftover turkey?
Absolutely. Absolutely you could. Yes, for sure. I mean, I think chicken and turkey leftovers are absolutely interchangeable.
All right, now I don't want to put this book aside because there's much more I'd like to talk about. But as you pointed out to me, this book wasn't written yesterday.
No,
this was written a year ago.
Yes, and it took more than a year to write.
And so you're celebrating it and going around talking about it, but. Are you working on anything else? Will you tell us about what you're working on?
Well, yeah. I mean, things are sort of complicated in New York publishing right now. Wiley, my publisher of this book and my immediate previous book, which is called Falling Off the Bone, all the, you know, cheap cuts of meat, has just sold its entire cookbook division. And there'd been rumors of this, and my agent in New York had been negotiating with Wiley for two book contract, had hammered out all of the details. We were ready to go, and my agent called me and he said, I don't know how to tell you this. Wiley has put a freeze on all contracts. So just this last week, the news broke that Houghton Mifflin, which had just filed for Chapter 11, has now bought the cookbook division.
Is that right?
Of Wiley. And I thought, good heavens. I mean, you know, they're in Chapter 11. But apparently Houghton Mifflin had been doing a lot of deals with Amazon. And the thinking is that Amazon may be a silent partner in this. We don't know. I mean, we may be getting books printed on demand. We may be getting e-books. But actually, it was a smart move because they're getting the whole Betty Crocker list of cookbooks, all of the Better Homes and Gardens cookbooks, which surely have to be good sellers.
So these are good forever. Many of these books are good forever,
right,
and will keep selling.
But the latest news is that my two new books will now be honored by Houghton Mifflin. And my Wiley editor, as of today, is a Houghton Mifflin editor.
So you've probably landed on your feet. Well, Gene, I want to follow up on this because I'm always curious about the economics of any kind of business, and particularly in writing. And can you make a good living writing cookbooks?
Touch wood. So far,
how does it work? I mean,
I will say it's becoming increasingly difficult. For the people I consider, quote, true blues, you know, who trained in food, who've devoted their lives to food, who test all the recipes, who do all of their own writing and research, we are now in the minority. What's also happened is that, you know, in the beginning, when I first started out writing books, which has been 40 years ago, the head people at the publishing houses were book people. Then along about the late 80s, we started getting all of these really smart young business school grads, some of whom were book people, but many of whom were not. So the bottom line became all important. And what has happened, I think, and this is really since the dawn of the Food Network, is that the celebrity cookbook is now the thing that will sell a lot of books fast. And the unfortunate thing that many people do not know is that many of these cookbooks, well, first of all, some, not all, but some of the people who are now, you know, television chefs or cooks or whatever, are failed actors they really don't know much about food, but they're
good. Comfortable in front of the cameras.
They're performing in the field of food, which I would love to be able to do, but unfortunately.
You're doing it today.
Well, radio. Yeah. I love radio. Anyway, so what publishers have now done, and three of my former editors are keeping themselves afloat by doing this, is that they are churning out, meaning ghosting, cookbooks for these, quote, celebrities to put their faces and names on. And what also is happening is that many of the recipes now that are in these books have never been tested. They're grabbed off the internet. They're grabbed, you know, wherever. And I have a website. I get a lot of complaints from people saying, you know, I made thus and so recipe from thus and so cookbook. It didn't work. What did I do wrong? And I say, send me the recipe. I'll look.
Mm. Well, Gene, talking about this is great. We got to finish up. But before we go, talking about your website, which is wonderful, and I don't want to say that you can get a lot of stuff that's in the book. You can get on your website, but it might be you if you're interested. Go to Gene's website, look at it, and then I bet you'll want the book too. But talk about your website just real quickly.
One of the things that
I tell you what, just give us the address because we're out of time.
Okay, www.geneandersoncooks.com.
Right, and we'll have a link on chapelborough.com to your website. Oh boy, I've had so much fun talking to Gene Anderson. If you joined us late, she is our neighbor in Chapel Hill, and her new book, From a Southern Oven, The Savories and the Sweets, joins a whole collection of 20 or so books that she's written before, all of them great. And we're proud of you, Gene Anderson.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. It's been D.G. Martin on Who's Talking. I'll be back here before you know it.